This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We are slated to hear from Representative Ted James and Andrew Mull from the American Cancer Society. They will share some insights about the legislative issues that are to come, primarily the governor's tax reform swap and the implications of an increase in cigarette taxes. That's among the topics of discussion, and of course we'll talk with Representative James about other issues regarding the budget. Also on the show, Timothy Keller, considered to be the top evangelical minister in the city of New York City. He is here to talk about his latest work, and we will talk with him about his conservative views in a city that is not as conservative as ours. All this, now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our numbers everywhere you may be. You may dial 877-217-5757, and if you're calling locally, please dial 297-5633. We can be reached also at our email address, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with the Reverend Timothy Keller, considered by many to be the top evangelical minister in New York City. He is a best-selling author of several books, and his latest is Jesus the King. Timothy Keller has been called by Newsweek as a C.S. Lewis for the 21st century. Good morning, Reverend Keller.
Here I am. Hi.
Nice to talk with you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's start, first of all, on a few topical matters. The Catholic Church is about to install a new pope. You're an evangelical minister in New York City, a city with a large Catholic population. Are you following this story?
Oh, yeah, sure. And the news media here, of course, certainly follows it, and it's certainly of interest to us all.
What do you make of the issues that have been permeating for a few years in the Catholic Church?
Well, I mean, the Catholic Church should be a lesson to anyone who's trying to run an institution of any kind, especially a church. It does seem like there's been some failure of governance. There just has to, I don't know how else to put it. And they've certainly lost a great deal of credibility, and actually, it certainly hurts any Christian ministry. It hurts the church in general. So it's a sad thing to see, and it's a thing of concern. And obviously I'm not that directly involved in any way, but I do know that I don't want to see the Catholic Church lose credibility. I don't want to see that. We share the Apostles' Creed, the basic ancient Christian faith, and certainly to see them in decline and to see them sort of beaten up in a lot of ways in our culture does not help. Does not help me. Doesn't mm-hmm. help the culture either.
Now, you say in decline, but in sheer numbers, there are over 1 billion Catholics on the planet. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. In America, I think this is also true of the Anglican Communion. The Church is alive and well and growing at something like, sometimes 7 to 10 times the population growth in Asia, Latin America, Africa, the Caribbean. It's mainly struggling in North America and Europe, where the churches, by the way, of North America and Europe tend to be more liberal than the churches in the rest of the world. And so it's too complex to say, the Catholic Church is in decline. I'm just saying that I think it's really taken a beating here, especially in Europe and in North America. And that doesn't help churches at all. I mean, in general, it hurts the church, I think. So I was thinking more along the lines of in Europe and North America.
All right. Reverend Keller, Timothy Keller, is the founding pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. And I mentioned, considered by many to be the top evangelical minister in New York City. How many are in your congregation, Reverend Keller?
Oh, we have about 5,000 or 6,000 people that come on a Sunday. And in Manhattan, that might make us, I think it might make us the largest. So it's very hard. It's a big city, And there are many different denominations. There are also many different racial and ethnic groups, many different languages that are preached, you know, on a Sunday. And so it's a little hard to lift any one up as the most prominent, I think.
What do you attribute your appeal, your and I'm hesitant to use the word success, but you have gathered a large flock.
I think I believe that when you the way to be persuasive in any on any subject is you have to go inside a person's beliefs. You're trying to persuade them. You could look inside. You find some beliefs that they have that you then can say, well, if you believe that, why can't you believe this? That's how persuasion always works. You take something that they already, you don't just beat on them. You don't just say, you're wrong and I'm right. That doesn't do a thing. You have to actually say, here's something I want you to think about. Here's an inconsistency in your own views. And here's why what I'm trying to show you is the case would make more sense of your view than you do yourself. Now, actually, I could, if I had time, I don't. Cool. I could say that all persuasion acts like that. And there's a tendency for people, especially in the internet age, not to try to persuade, but just try to rant, just yell, and also try to, you might say, energize your own base, so that they'll support you, and then you just try to get your way through power. I don't think that's the Christian way. I don't think that fits in with a Savior who died on the cross praying for his enemies. And we come here to try to serve, and we come here to try to preach, yes, the gospel, but in a way that is compelling to people. Even if they disagree with it in the end, they'll feel the force of the arguments because you're trying to persuade, not just trying to beat them up.
And that brings us to your writing, and you have been a prolific writer, and as I stated, your latest work, Jesus the King, Understanding the Life and Death of the Son of God, certainly an appropriate read during the Holy Season. This is a topic that many, as you know, have covered and have come away with different points of view. What about your search for salvation and for finding who is responsible for making us all what we are and making the earth all of what it is and the planet? And what is your finding bringing you to as a way of understanding all this at the age of 62?
First, I actually started writing fairly recently. I decided that I've spent a fair amount of time preaching and teaching and reading and trying to figure out what I think was the truth. And I didn't start writing until I was actually about 57 or 58. And I partly did that because I didn't want to start to go off and publish things before I came to my conclusions, and I tend to be a deliberate person. And so in the last few years, what I've tried to do is I've basically have been taking the things that I found help people to answer the questions you just asked, you just mentioned. What's the meaning of life? If there is a God, how do I connect to him? The Christian answer basically is different than other religions. The Christian answer is that religion is not really about living a good life so that God will bless you and answer your prayers. Christianity is about God coming to earth in the form of Jesus Christ to save us, not to show us how to save ourselves, but to save us by grace, to accomplish our salvation for us. We receive that salvation by humbling ourselves. It's not the good are in and the bad are out, but the humble are in and the proud are out. And that basic idea of grace salvation creates a certain kind of Christian community, a certain kind of human identity, and I think from that center, we work out the answers to your questions like how should we live in the world and how do we connect to God and how should we be living our lives, what should we spend our time doing. And but it took me a while before I figured I was able to put this in a way that was perhaps more comprehensive to most people, so I didn't really start writing until fairly recently.
You have been called by Christianity Today as a pioneer for urban Christians.
Yeah. Well, I love cities, and I have for quite a long time. The cities of the non-Western world are growing like crazy. People are pouring into them. And basically, more and more, the world is becoming an urban world. The cities of America were, I'm old enough to remember in the 70s, 60s and 70s and early 80s, when everybody thought the cities of America were really falling apart and they'd had it, and that, you know, the age of the city was over. But, of course, they've totally changed. They've been renewed at the core. And so I'd say today, more and more, as the city goes, so goes the world. As the city goes, so goes the cultures of the world. And I just felt like if Christians want to have anything to say to how human life is lived in the world, they need to be in cities. So that has been my clarion call. There's a tendency for churches and Christians to go where it's cheaper and where there's less pluralism and where there's fewer people that differ with them and hole up in more comfortable places. And I don't think that that's actually very helpful to society. I'm not sure that's the best way to be, you know, in mission for Jesus Christ. So, yes, I'm a proponent for living and ministering in cities.
297-5633, if you'd like to join us in our remaining time with Reverend Timothy J. Keller. His latest work is Jesus the King. He's also the author of The Reason for God, Belief in an Age of Skepticism, a New York Times bestseller, and New York's top minister in terms of sheer numbers, over 5,000 people in his congregation at the Redeemer Presbyterian Church. If Jesus were walking the streets of New York City today, what do you think he would think and do?
He would probably notice consumeristic individualism. So, which is what matters to me is my own satisfaction, fulfillment. That's more important than commitment, relationship, common good, community. That's what's most important. And he would, I think, actually, he would, well, it's interesting because he would preach against that, of course. But if you really look at the Bible, you'll see that he preaches a great deal about that anyway. I mean, he's constantly talking about people being more generous with their, I mean, two ways he would see this in New York. One is people are not generous with their money. They tend to accrue it. They tend to feel like it's theirs. They get their identity from what they consume and what they buy and the brands that they're able to buy in the neighborhoods they're able to live in. But actually, I think he'd also point out that the way having sex outside of marriage is just as consumeristic. What you're really saying is, I want to have the fulfillment of sex, but I don't want to give myself. In other words, traditional Christian understanding is that sex is a way of giving yourself completely to somebody else in marriage. So you shouldn't give yourself physically without giving yourself wholly and completely, legally, economically, psychologically, in every way, and you're married. He would actually, I think, see a connection between having sex outside of marriage and being materialistic. He would say, basically, you're living for yourself and not for others. You just do not know how to give yourself to others. You only know how to take. He already says that in the Bible, so you really don't have to, you know, say, what would Jesus say? I can just preach the Bible, and it's very relevant to New York.
Well, is it any different now than it was 2,000 years ago when it comes to most of us looking out for number one?
We are an individualistic society, so everybody is going to make an idol out of something. You're going to make a god out of something. And I think traditional cultures made a god out of the family, out of the tribe, out of the race. You know, so our race is right and your race should be enslaved. Today we make an idol out of individual achievement. The world looks more egalitarian, but it's not more just. So I would say it was different, but at the same time, underneath, it's not. So at least at one level, it is different. There's a big difference between Western, late modern individualism and, traditional shame and honor cultures, which is what he was living in. But at the same time, underneath, it's still a matter of self-salvation, idolatry, pride, a refusal to acknowledge God as God.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. We will return and spend a few more minutes with the Reverend Timothy J. Keller And also hear from Representative Ted James. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. In just a bit, we'll hear from Representative Ted James and from Andrew Mull of the American Cancer Society. And they'll be here to talk about, first of all, the proposed increase in tobacco taxes, cigarette taxes, that Governor Jindal has changed his mind on and will be part of his package, presumably, when he issues it in a week or so. We resume with Reverend Timothy Keller, who is pastor of the Redeemer Presbyterian Church. He was the founder of that church in New York City with more than 5,000 congregants. For somebody who wants to come to Manhattan and visit your church, where are you located, Reverend Keller?
You're going to have to go onto the web because we're located in three places. We have eight services. There are four services on the west side at a building on West 83rd Street. There's two services on the east side where we meet at Hunter College Auditorium in 68th between Park and Lexington. And we also meet downtown on West 14th Street at the Salvation Army between 6th and 7th Avenues. So there's plenty of times and plenty of places.
You have a mixed congregation?
Sure, I think I... Yes. What do you mean by mixed?
Well, I mean, do you have lots of ethnic groups?
Well, it's New York. Yes, I'd say I think we may be 50% white, perhaps. I think maybe we're not 50. We may be 49% or something like that. It's also two-thirds single. It's very, very young. It's mainly people under the age of 35.
And you're a bit older than that. How do you relate to people who are younger than you?
Well, yes, people actually ask me, why does a 62-year-old guy have such a young congregation? Part of the answer is that that's New York. In other words, we're in Manhattan, and this is a young people's mecca. You know, people come here, and so there they are. And the people say, how do you have so many singles? Well, most of the people who live in New York are single, actually, at least in Manhattan, this part. But as I said earlier, I think you also have to, if the preaching and the ministry does not engage with people's actual questions and concerns, then they're not going to come. If the preaching does, then people will be interested.
Timothy Keller, author of Jesus the King. Paul on Plank Road, you're on the air. Good morning, Paul. You're on with Reverend Keller.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask Reverend Keller to comment on the relationship between traditional Christian teaching on creation and what modern science is learning about the universe. Thank you.
All right, good question from Paul.
Well, that's a big subject, so the best thing to do is lay down a principle. And the principle is Christians have always believed that there's two books. There's the book of the Bible and the book of nature. That God actually speaks to us in a way through both. He speaks unmistakably through the Bible. But he also, you know, since he made the world, when science studies the world, we're actually studying how God has done things. The real question always comes up is when it looks like the book of the Bible and the book of, you know, science or nature conflict. My belief is since science is rather continually changing its mind fairly often, I'm old enough to know that over 20 years, science can make some pretty big changes, that I'm pretty slow to change what I think the Bible's saying. In other words, obviously at a certain point, there may be some ways you could look at the Bible and say, we now know that the earth goes around the sun. So anybody who interpreted the Bible as the sun going around the earth was making a mistake. I think we can say that now. But when people come to me and say, well, science now shows that all human beings did not descend from one couple, I remember Time magazine something like 20 years ago saying that studies have now shown that all human beings did come down from one couple. So I think I don't want to go changing what I think the plain sense of the scripture every 20 years just because the latest thing comes out from science. So I have a tendency to stick with the scripture and what and my understanding of the scripture, though I know that I might be wrong in interpreting the Bible. So generally speaking, there's two books and yet the Bible is the one that I think has preeminence over what science tells me because science changes the Bible is the Bible. So that's too brief answer to a very, very big question.
Do you have a sense, based on your studies of the Bible and of science, Reverend Keller, as to how old the Earth is?
Oh, well, I'm what people call an old Earth believer. In other words, I don't believe the Earth is new or young. I don't believe God made the world a few thousand years ago and therefore deceived all of, you know, geology and all kinds of science. I don't think the Bible teaches that the Earth is young.
Okay.
I don't think Genesis 1 and 2 teach that. So, yeah, that's what makes some people would consider me open to evolution, but actually I'm pretty wary about evolution. I just don't think the Bible teaches that the Earth is young.
Well, finally, as far as your book, Jesus the King, for those who are going to hear or are hearing your voice and will pick up a copy, what is the basic message that you convey in this book?
That Jesus Christ came. This is from Paul, of course, First Timothy. He summed the gospel like this: Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. That's it.
All right. Well, thank you, Reverend Keller. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and we hope to talk again. You're an interesting man.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
Take care. God bless.
You too.
297-5633 is your number, and we're joined in studio by Reverend, I just promoted somebody, Representative Ted James and Andrew Mull, who is the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society, and they're here to talk about, first off, the governor's change in his viewpoint on tobacco taxes, cigarette taxes. Remember, last time we talked with Andrew, I believe the governor was resisting an increase from 32 to 36 cents, which was a renewal of a tax. Now, as we heard from Tim Barfield from the Department of Revenue yesterday, the governor is most likely going to call for an increase of over a dollar per pack. Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we're certainly encouraged that the governor is supportive of increasing the price of cigarettes. Obviously, we know that it's a win for health. It saves lives. It's a win for state revenue. It generates a lot of money. And it also saves a lot of dollars in health care treatment. And
well, why do you think he changed his mind?
I can't really speculate on that. We know that it's something that needs to be done for the state, and we're certainly encouraged by it. We would like for the money to go to health care. I know that I think his proposal is putting the money towards the state general fund. We would really like to see those dollars go back into tobacco cessation, tobacco control, and to manage and treat chronic diseases. We feel like that's a good place for the dollars to go. But the important thing is raising the price will help reduce youth smoking rates and adult smoking rates. And again, it'll generate substantial revenue for the state.
Do you have a feel on how high the governor will go in his proposal?
I only know what I've read in the paper. I think he is wanting to go a $1.05 increase, which would put us the same as our state, same as the state of Texas, at $1.41. So that's certainly encouraging. We would like to go higher than that because 11 states have increased the cigarette tax since 2011. And we're still way behind when it comes to being near the national average. So we would like to see a $1.25 increase. I think we would like to see a higher amount.
To get to New York levels, we would have to increase it by $3. So $4 actually. $4. Would you be in favor of that?
Yeah, the higher the better for us. We obviously want it to be as high as possible because, as you know, every substantial increase does have a dramatic youth reduction rate.
Okay. 297-5633, Representative Ted James, what's your assessment based on your early reading of the governor's plan?
I was shocked to see that he had changed his stance. And, you know, I didn't have the opportunity to serve in the legislature during the 4-cent renewal debate, but I watched at bay and could not believe that he would veto such a measure. Now I know that the governor is including this to save his tax swap, and unfortunately, I would like to see, and I don't think that the increase in revenue will go to health benefits. I think the governor will try to send those funds directly to the general fund to help with this assault on the middle class with this tax swap. I, like Andrew, would like to see, and I'm co-sponsoring a bill with Harold Ritchie, who led the charge last time, to see that these funds are directly benefit healthcare in the state.
Well, is it your perception that you could increase the cigarette tax and reject other parts of the governor's package, or is this an all-or-nothing proposition?
I think the governor is going to come with an all-or-nothing proposition, and I think that's a mistake on his part. My colleagues, there are several parts of the discussions that I've had with Tim Barfield and Jason DeQuire that I agree with the governor's tax proposal, this being one of them. I just disagree with it going to the general fund. And if he wants to have an honest debate, him putting all of these measures in one instrument will be a fatal flaw for his plan.
Well, Governor Jindal, his plan for eliminating the state's personal income and corporate taxes will be unveiled next week, according to the Jindal administration. And we'll know much more at that time, but bits and pieces have been filtered somewhat. Have you actually had meetings with the governor, or have your meetings been with Mr. Barfield and Jason DeQuire and others who are not the governor, but certainly have a place at the table with the governor?
I've had meetings with both the governor as well as the staff of the Department of Revenue. In those meetings, we very open dialogue. Members were we discussed a lot of flaws we saw with the proposal. And once we see the instruments, I would hope that a lot of our concerns will be addressed once we see the final documents. I'm not all too confident in that, based on our past relationship and the past and this administration. I'm waiting patiently. I don't think that we'll see him next week. I think that we'll see him closer to the deadline. I will be very surprised if we get him early enough to actually have some time to review him before we start legislative session.
When and where did you meet with the governor, Representative James?
I think it was about 2 weeks ago in the governor's mansion. We had a great meeting with Capital Region delegation, and we were able to hear a lot of the preliminary proposals. And the governor had a chance to present those as well as Mr. Barfield.
297-5633 for Representative Ted James and Andrew Mull of the American Cancer Society. HB in Denham Springs, good morning to you, HB.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
According to what you're saying here, aren't we counting on two different aspects of this particular tax increase? On one hand, we're saying we're going to use this money for the tax increase on cigarettes or tobacco products in order to beef up the coffers of state government, while on the other hand, you're hoping that the price of this stuff and the tax on it will cause people to quit smoking, therefore not putting money in the coffers. Your opinion on that, please, sir. Thank you.
Well, I think that's why we want the money to go back into health care, because it is a declining source of revenue, and that's what we want, because as the revenue declines, that means smoking rates are declining. So the money goes back into health care. We see that as really the most logical fit, because healthcare costs will also decline over time. So it may not be parallel, but you will see a decrease in healthcare costs as well as a decline in the revenue that's generated.
Now, Representative James, you represent a district that is less well off than many others, and an increase in the sales tax could affect some constituents of yours adversely, perhaps more so than it would affect somebody with means. What are your constituents telling you? Are they engaged in this at all?
My constituents are very concerned, and I have a lot of retirees, farmers, state government workers, and they are very concerned with what they're hearing. And unfortunately, I don't have specifics to be able to talk to them about it. That's why I'm waiting at bay to see these proposals. But I know that my constituents are, they understand the impact of increased sales taxes. Not only my constituents, but I've been having conversations with Sheriff's Association across the state, school boards. This will extremely hinder the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board from progressing as we've seen them progress in the past 2 years. This will affect not only state government, but local governments here in Baton Rouge and across the state.
297-5633. Remember, Governor Jindal, a couple of years ago declined an increase to, when I say increase, it was a renewal of a 4-cent tax on tobacco, and the governor said that he was not in favor of any new taxes, and he considered that a new tax. Now, this plan, I don't think there's any doubt, involves a whole lot of new taxes, and no matter what the governor comes up with, there will be a flurry of new taxes, perhaps including one on media advertising, among others. It's a wide-sweeping plan with so much on the table. How much attention will be given to the portion of it that involves an increase in tobacco taxes?
Well, we hope a lot. I mean, this is one of the few taxes that has large public support. Over 70% of the population mm-hmm. in Louisiana support a cigarette tax increase. So this is one that the public supports. So we would think that this would be a win for our elected officials. And it also does great. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're also we also rank really high in youth smoking rates and you know, healthcare costs that we have to spend on those who smoke, and lives lost. We rank high in all those categories. So this is a way to lower some of those rankings, save lives, and do what's right for the state.
$1.05, that would raise over $300 million estimated, wouldn't it?
Close to that. We have a projection for a dollar increase to raise right around $225 million. We kind of figure it's about $2.5 million per penny that's generated. So it would be in that neighborhood.
And it's a tricky way to project, because you have to factor in those who will no longer smoke or not smoke as much because they can't afford it.
Sure.
Or don't want to pay it. So you're doing that with your projection.
Absolutely. And this is actually one of the easier types of increases to project year to year.
But the way I got the $300 million was, I know that when we were talking about the 4-cent renewal, we were talking about $12 million. So I just did $3 million for every penny raised. And if
right.
it's $1.05, that would be $315 million.
Right. And the more you increase it, the lower per penny that it does generate.
Okay. So you're saying around $250 million.
To raise it that much, it would
quarter
be
quarter of a billion dollars. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. And again, I think it's important to stress that for Appropriations Committee members, Finance Committee members, it's a pretty easy to project source of revenue. You can really forecast it year to year, unlike other types of increases.
Well, what about smokers who have a habit and are often treated as second-class citizens? Is it a war on people who smoke? Representative James?
I don't think so. And a lot of the folks that I represent who are smokers are those same folks that are in desperate need of these services. And I know that this type of increase will prevent our teenagers. And for me, it is very personal. I've lost two uncles to cancer related to their history of smoking, and it started at a very young age. And I don't think it's an assault on them. It's geared towards helping them.
877-217-5757 is your number wherever you are for Ted James and Andrew Moll. We'll be back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. Andrew Moll, Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society, and Ted James, representative from Baton Rouge. He represents a good portion of this community in the Louisiana House of Representatives. Governor Jindal will propose a tax revamp, overhaul, whatever you want to call it. It's a big change, and he says it's coming in the next week or so. The session starts April the 8th, and among the items that will be on the governor's agenda, an increase in tobacco taxes, cigarette taxes, could go up $1.05, according to Andrew Moll and others who have talked with insiders in the Jindal administration. Ted James has actually talked with the governor, who promised to meet with every lawmaker before going forward with his plan. He'll need two-thirds support, the governor will, in both the House and the Senate to advance any proposal that is offered. Ted James, can he get the votes?
I don't think so. And I say that based on last year. You see his proposals last year, and they were able to fly through the legislature without the type of compromise that many of us wanted to see. Most of those proposals have since been ruled unconstitutional. So I would hope that this year we do things differently and allow an open, honest debate. There are, like I said, there are several things that I personally agree with the plan. All or nothing, I can't support. And if the governor is serious about turning the tide here in Louisiana, we can't just cut. I believe we've cut down to the bone, and we have to look at new sources of revenue. And the truth of the matter is, you said it, Jim, we'll propose several tax increases. I know he wants to say revenue neutral, but the plan that I saw, several tax increases, and the people of Louisiana need to know that.
Do you think there will be widespread opposition? Will there be people storming the Capitol? Will there be rallies outside? What's going to happen?
Well, I think once we're able to see what the actual proposals are, I know that there's a lot of concern out there from, like I said, school boards, local governments, sheriff's associations, police jury. And I would hope that the people of Louisiana take an active part in the political process. The doors of the Capitol are open. I know that our teachers may not think so, but it's important for the people to get out and play a very active role, because we need to hear those voices. And, you know, some of my colleagues, it's important that we get that support from our constituents, so we know how they feel about certain instruments before we actually vote on them.
Sam asked about the court decisions, which you referenced, going against the governor. Have those influenced lawmakers to any degree regarding support or opposition to this plan?
I've heard from several of my colleagues, and you know, I'm not one of those "I told you so" members of the legislature, but We talked about all these things, and there were several amendments to correct some of the things that we've heard. Some of the legal opinions from the judges are, it looks like a direct repeat of our legislative transcript, some of the things that we talked about. And I know that certain members who voted on those bills wish they could get those votes back.
Really?
Yes, I know that.
So are they less likely or more likely to support Governor Jindal and his initiatives this time?
Well, I can't speak to those folks, but I would hope that they're more inclined to being open-minded with our debate. And because we have different ideas about how certain things need to be done to move our state forward, that doesn't mean you shut your ear to those things. And I believe that as a body, we will take more independence and trust the individual members and not just allow the administration to ram things down our throats this year.
Here's another inquiry from LD. Does the governor's sagging poll numbers have an effect on lawmakers' support?
Not me. He's been his poll numbers have always been low, in my opinion.
Well, he got reelected with 66%.
In my opinion, if you look at District 101, he only had about 30% of the vote. And the folks that I represent, I think that my district lost trust in the governor long time ago. But I think that he has an opportunity to do something about that. It's just I know he has national ambition, and I applaud him for his national ambition. But I think that he will do a much better job in his nationwide appeal if he shows that he's a governor that's willing to compromise, if he shows that he's a governor who's willing to listen to those voices that may not always agree with him. But in his history, he hasn't done that.
Why do you think people have lost faith in him?
Well, I mean, if you're a college student and your matriculation has been extended for two or three semesters because of the cuts to your institution, you have to lose faith in them. If you're an employee of LSU Health Services System and you rely on those clinics, especially in my area, Earl K. Long, you have to lose faith in them. If you're a retired state worker and your benefits have been threatened for the last 2 years, you have to lose faith in them. And I think that these things are continuing to build and build. And that's why his numbers are as low as they are now.
All right. Well, a moment ago you said it's going to be an all or nothing proposition. So how do you separate the parts you like from those that you don't?
Well, for me, I'm filing separate bills. He's mentioned the severance tax. I'm filing bills in regards to those things, the tobacco tax. Harold Ritchie and I will be sponsoring a bill to deal with those things. Motion picture tax credits, I'm filing something to address those things. And I know that other members have.
What are you doing along those lines?
Well, I think that as a community, especially here in Baton Rouge, you see all of the movie trucks and you think that we're getting a big bang for our buck here. But when you look at the number of people who claim those motion picture credits, they aren't in the motion picture industry. And I would like to see those credits now are refundable and transferable. Most states don't allow both. My bill, I want to have a conversation about the refundability and transferability of those credits. And I think that we can make changes and still keep the industry here in the state.
Okay, so how does it work now for somebody who has one of those credits?
Well, right now, if you take advantage of the motion picture credit and your tax liability, your credit exceeds your liability, you can get a check directly from the state. Or you can sell those back to the state for 85% on the dollar, and our high wage earners and folks can buy those credits and apply those credits to reduce their tax liability. And I don't think that we should be losing as much money as we're losing with that credit.
So you're saying they can be sold back at 85 cents?
Yes.
After they get the tax break?
Yes.
So this could be a business proposition.
A tax dodge. A lot of folks are getting checks directly from the state. And I know that Secretary Murray will tell you differently about the success of this program. But when you look at the fact that the jobs that are coming here are not full-time jobs. We're getting a lot of part-time workers. Mm-hmm. The benefit to the state is just not there, and that's the honest truth about this program. And I believe that we can make changes, keep the industry here, but make changes to increase revenues in the state.
Right. A question from Ryan. Is there any ceiling on the tax credits for the movie industry? Are you capped at any point?
No, and that's a great question, because most of our credits don't have caps, and I
all
know
right,
that.
So a business could borrow $1 million, uh-huh. Okay, and then you're saying use it as a tax credit and then get $855,000 back from the state? Is that what you're saying?
If you are in the motion picture industry and you have a credit for, let's say, $1 billion, and your tax liability is only $1 million, you can get a check back for the amount between what your actual liability is and the amount of the credit. And I think that once you look at other states, they don't allow those credits to be transferred and refunded. And they are seeing a great benefit from the industry being in their state, but they're also not giving away as much money as we are here in Louisiana.
Well, why do you think they're not being used by people in the movie industry?
Well, I don't know that, but I do know that I see a lot of movies, programs being filmed here in Louisiana. And when you look at the tax liability, I believe that our credit is so beneficial to the industry. They're able to do their business and still have an excess amount of money to get a check back from the state.
Okay. 297-5633. Belinda at LSU. Belinda, you're on the air with Representative James and Andrew Mull. Hi, Belinda.
Hi. I'd like to say, first off, I'm very excited about the tobacco tax. I think it's a great idea. But we hear Governor Jindal say that his plan is revenue neutral. I'd like to ask Representative James if we should answer the question, revenue neutral for whom? Thank you.
I think that's a great question, and I believe that that's the governor has a lot of buzzwords. Flatter and leaner, revenue neutral, and those are being used so he won't be honest with the people that we are increasing certain taxes. I'm the only member of the legislature to have worked in the Department of Revenue, so I know a lot about our tax credits. I know which ones were credits that we looked at when I worked in the Department of Revenue and certain changes that needed to be made. But I just hope that as a body, we're able to have these great conversations. And I know that my motion picture credit bill may not be something that folks are going to run and jump to. But once they get the information, I believe that we can make some great changes on it.
Now, the Stelly plan, you were in the Department of Revenue when that debate was ongoing, weren't you?
No, I was actually working with Governor Blanco at the time when they first made the changes. But I know that Stella has always been a conversation.
Should
for folks
that have been repealed?
I don't think so. I didn't happen to be in the legislature then, but I worked in the Capitol, and I remember discussions, and I remember our legislators being warned not to do it. And I see now that hindsight is 2020. If you look mm-hmm. back, I know that there are some members, past members of the legislature who I've talked to, and they recognize that as a mistake that we made as a state.
All right. Still time to talk with Andrew Mull and Ted James, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. And the legislative session begins in a month and 2 days, and it promises to be quite a showdown at the Capitol. And the governor needs 70 votes in the House. He'll need 26 votes in the Senate to forward his agenda, and that could be a tough call with the Republicans holding majorities now in both houses, but Democrats having a distinct minority, so he's got to get some Democratic votes. Do any of your Democratic colleagues, Ted James, do they show any kind of inkling towards supporting this plan?
I think most of my colleagues are just as their position now is we want to see a bill. I know that there are a lot of concerns with what we're hearing with the districts that we represent, but you know, folks aren't taking mm-hmm. a stance now because we haven't seen an instrument. I know that the things that I've heard are troubling to me when you put them all in one or two instruments. And I don't see a lot of my colleagues supporting the proposals if it's done in that fashion again.
Does this, Andrew Mull, cast a pall over the tobacco legislation? Is it going to be hard to separate this from the bigger discussion?
We don't think so. We think the bill that Harold Ritchie will be filing, that Ted James will be co-sponsoring, is a more comprehensive approach to doing this. And we really, I think from our standpoint, we're not going to weigh in on any kind of broad tax reform package. But we know that having a standalone measure where the money goes right back into health care is a smart approach. And so we applaud Harold Ritchie for doing that, and of course for Ted James for also co-sponsoring it, and we're looking at getting more support.
Ryan on Corsi. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air with Ted and Andrew.
Hi. I apologize. I've caught the program late. I don't know if this was something that was discussed, but I was curious as to whether or not there was any data that suggested that repealing the state income tax is something that businesses and individuals have said was a barrier to doing business.
All right. Is the state income tax, is that a hindrance to getting things done in our state?
I think it depends on who you ask. The governor, he will shed light on different groups that rank the state. And, of course, he will shed light on those that are more in tune with his position, but I don't see how we're already operating at a $1 billion deficit and you repeal another $3 billion. I don't see how we survive doing that without being honest about the need for new revenues.
Lee in Geismar. Hi, Lee, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm sort of curious as to the whole program of the flat taxes and getting rid of the income tax. If you get rid of the corporate income tax, it seems to me that you have to raise taxes on the middleman. Somebody's got to come up with the difference.
I agree with you, and that's my concern with the program, with the proposal, based on the details that I've seen. A couple of years ago, you would – And not even a couple of years ago, but Governor Jindal and Secretary Murray, they are always talking about how Louisiana is great for business. The business tax proposals and incentives that were passed, these were great for Louisiana and helped us recruit all these businesses to Louisiana. Now you're telling us that we need to do something totally different when for the last 4 or 5 years, He's bragged about our national rankings, and now you're telling me that these things weren't good enough. And we're always doing something for business, and I'm not anti-business at all, but if we're asking college students to tighten their belts, we're asking state workers to tighten their belts, we need to do the same thing with the businesses here in Louisiana. And when you look at the credits that are out there, most of them have been taken advantage of by the larger corporations, and not the small businesses, and they're definitely not haven't been
all
beneficial
right, well,
to the
quickly
middleman.
We're short on time. Who does it help the most, the plan, and who will it hurt the most?
In my opinion, it helps the large businesses here, and for individuals, those of us who, not those of us, but those in the state of Louisiana who are high wage earners. It definitely hurts retirees. It definitely hurts most of the folks that I represent who are middle class.
You're saying it hurts low wage earners.
Yes,
right?
I'm sorry. Yeah, it hurts low wage earners. It hurts retirees. It hurts local government. It hurts our school boards and our police jurors.
Okay, well, we'll follow it. Thank you, Ted James. Thank you, Andrew Mull. Certainly, this is one that we will keep talking about. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.